Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
And hey, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Okay, so today I want to talk about one of the recent Supreme Court decisions that will affect workers and union members going forward. Really, to put a little bit of a point on it, the decision affects the ability of workers to strike against their employers. The case at hand is called Glacier Northwest versus the Teamsters, where Glacier Northwest, a concrete company, sued the Teamsters Union and their own employees for damages resulting from a strike. And I'll flesh this out a bit as we go, but I just want to give the very basic outline of the case here for anyone who isn't aware yet. The drivers of Glacier's concrete trucks are represented by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and the collectively bargained contract that they had operated under ran out, and after about a month of negotiations that went nowhere, the drivers decided to strike. And then they struck. They did exactly what they were going to do. Now, the drivers decided to strike at 7 a.m. one morning. So, drivers starting at and after 7 a.m. simply did not go to work. Those already at work, drivers who had trucks loaded with concrete to be delivered, to be specific, parked their trucks and kept them running with the drum spinning to keep the concrete from setting and anyone on the road return to the yard. Returning drivers with concrete still in their drums parked the vehicles and left them running again with the drum spinning, all in an effort to keep the concrete from setting and causing damage. So just to be clear, the drivers who had concrete loaded into their trucks parked them, left the engines running, left the drum spinning, and walked out the door. The supervisors were aware of what happened. This action forced the supervisors and possibly non-union workers, if there were any there, to hurry up and dump the concrete and wash out the trucks before the concrete dried out and set and damaged the vehicles. No trucks were damaged, but all the concrete was a loss. This action is the central issue at hand here. The workers say that they did everything reasonable to protect the trucks and keep the concrete from setting, and the company says that what the workers did was wanton disregard for the equipment and essentially sabotage. The company sued on the grounds that the actions of the workers were malicious. The Washington State Court dismissed the case because federal labor law, that which governs unions and strikes, preempt the claim for damages. This has been the lay of the law land for many years. Basically, federal law trumps state law, as written in the Constitution. Now, the labor law that this references is primarily from a Supreme Court case called San Diego Building Trades Council v. Garmin, which I'll just call Garmin from now on to save a little bit of breath. There have been other related and supplemental decisions, but Garmin is the big one here. The primary issue in the Garmin case, the specifics here really aren't important, to be honest, is that the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that if labor actions that cause issues and damages can be, quote-unquote, arguably subject, and this is a key phrase here, arguably subject to the National Labor Relations Act, then any disciplinary action or legal or tort claims resulting from those acts, in this case suing for $11,000, should go through the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. I hope that makes sense how I explain that. But to boil it down just a little bit more, this basically says that if workers strike and some company property is damaged due in some way to that strike and the company wants to sue, then the question has to be asked if the labor action that resulted in these damages is arguably subject to the National Labor Relations Act. Again, arguably subject is the term here. For it not to fall under the NLRA, it would have to be inarguable that, it is not protected. This absolutely is not the case in Glacier Northwest. In fact, I will make an argument here that it should be covered. In fact, a Supreme Court justice will make the argument herself that this action should be covered due to the very fact that it is arguable. And it's kind of weird on the face that, you know, the Supreme Court is saying that this is inarguable, even as they argue about it in the courtroom after lawyers argued about it for months. The state court ruled one way, the NLRB actually accepted the company's complaint and began an investigation. Then the Supreme Court said the state court was wrong, or at least part of the Supreme Court did, because they argued about this. It's been arguably subject ever since it happened. We know this because it's being argued about. It's kind of an absurd situation, to be honest. So the NLRA, being a federal law, it trumps state law. And this is what the Washington State Court saw and ruled on when they threw the case out. Glacier should have filed a complaint through the NLRB and not sued through the state. And by the way, they did file a complaint. The NLRB accepted it. They said, hey, this sounds like there might be merit here. They're looking at it. I honestly don't know if they're still doing an investigation, but I believe that they are. And that's what Glacier should have waited for. Now, one of the few small exceptions to this arguably subject standard is the intentional destruction of property, basically sabotage, including things like trucks. Now, the big thing here is that without these protections established in Garmin and other cases, companies could financially drown every union that they encounter every single time that there was a work stoppage. Garmin establishes that the federal laws that direct such cases to the NLRB should take precedent. It's basically a protection against frivolous and numerous civil lawsuits. Glacier argued that by leaving the concrete in the trucks, the drivers were trying to actively destroy property. But I'd argue, and the union certainly would argue, and some Supreme Court justices argued, that the drivers took enough precautions to protect the equipment. They left them running, they left the drums spinning, and they told the bosses that the trucks were there. Again, the company, the union, lawyers, judges, Supreme Court justices, they're all arguing with each other while also claiming that this is inarguable. So that's just the way of the world right now. I don't know how to explain that.
And hello there, everybody. As most of you probably know, this podcast takes a lot of time and effort to put together and, you know, to get out there for you good folks to listen to. And you, our listeners, can help us by liking and subscribing on YouTube. So please take a second to click those little buttons. It helps a ton. And if you are feeling just a little bit more generous and you enjoy what we do here at Tribunus Plebis Media, you can help us earn just a little bit of money for the large amount of labor that we put into this thing by signing up on our Buy Me a Coffee page, where you can make a one-time donation or sign up for a recurring monthly subscription. We do all of this for free, and we will never run ads in our works. But any contributions really do help keep the show going and improving. The page address is buymeacoffee.com/TribunusPlebis. And of course, all links will be in the show notes and descriptions wherever you are listening or watching. Thank you. And now, back to the episode.
Now, another aspect of this thing to note and talk about is that workers are protected from things like the concrete being ruined by a strike. This has been challenged and repeatedly affirmed that workers can't be held responsible for lost income or for things like slaughtered meat going bad, things like milk or cheese spoiling because of a strike, or even crops being left to go unpicked to, you know, wilt and rot in the fields. All of those specific things, and more, and like literally those specific things, those are actual Supreme Court cases, they have been challenged in the Supreme Court, and the workers and unions have won every single one of them. So this case comes down to what the workers did with the trucks, which again, the workers took precautions to protect them. And now the court decided to upend this long-standing precedent by following an overly pedantic and technical and narrow view of the case and deciding that the workers meant to destroy property. And this is a very big problem for organized labor. That a court could even come to a decision like this goes very far in showing just how corrupt and unethical the Supreme Court is as a whole, and not just the individual justices like Clarence Thomas, who, by the way, was recently exposed for taking millions in gifts from a billionaire influence peddler. The corruption is baked right into the court itself. It reveals the nature of power in this country, the dynamics of it, from where it flows to where it leads, and all those who divert, damn, corrupt, and monopolize this power as it flows to its inevitable end, the pockets of the capital elite. And there might be some folks out there who are like, you know, good, screw it, I'm glad that the company won. But hey, listen, I've got news for all of you guys too. Unless you're the owner of a giant construction company or some other massive profit center, the Supreme Court gives absolutely zero thought to you. You will lose just as much as these workers will lose if they lose to Glacier. This might be generally framed as a blow to unions, and you might hate unions or just not care about them, but while I will be talking a lot about unions here, I'm sure, you know, I want to be very clear about something. This decision affects all of us. It is a direct attack on all workers, and this includes, you know, independent contractors as well. They might not call you an employee, but you damn sure are an employee. We are all workers. This is, in fact, a class struggle. It's a front of the class war, and if you're cheering this on and you aren't a millionaire industrialist, you're aiding and abetting the enemy with every fist pump and political donation you make, which perpetuates this offensive. This decision is sapping power from organized labor, and by doing that, it is stripping working class laborers of their own personal empowerment. The court wasn't right. The corporations didn't just win. We all lost. The working class, the American laborer, the single mom, the single dad, the blue-collar, grease and dirt cake, bloody-knuckled, tired-to-the-bone working-class American family. They all lost. At a time of a great return of enthusiasm to the American labor movement, as labor wins small victory after small victory as they organize Amazon warehouses, Starbucks shops, and even strip clubs, the Supreme Court simultaneously kicked a leg out from the organized labor table and reinforced the ruling class's power with one moronic decision. And while you might sympathize in some way with an expensive truck theoretically being damaged, and again, no trucks were actually damaged, or you might even have an issue with the lost concrete, just know that this decision disempowers you, your friends, your family, and anyone else fighting for better wages, healthcare, safety, and just basic human dignity. What the decision opens up, and why it's so bad for unions across the board, is that it opens them up to what could be incredibly expensive lawsuits and even duplicate lawsuits, all stemming from the same action. If workers walk away and leave a machine running that could potentially overheat and be ruined, the company could sue. If they strike and maybe don't start a machine that needs to be run every so often and it becomes damaged, they could be sued for damages. And this isn't even to mention how open it leaves, you know, protections from eroding for things like rotting fruit or spoiled milk, which could lead to even more litigation and costs. And now, if you Google this case, you will see a lot of articles from places like CNN or MSNBC or Vox or, you know, whoever else you see on those first few pages. You'll see a lot of headlines and articles that are basically saying, this isn't so bad. Or maybe something like, yeah, this is a gut punch to labor, but it could have been worse. And this is just some, you know, I guess pedantic and technical nonsense. This is the sort of thinking that got even a couple of the more liberal justices to sign on to the majority opinion. They agreed with a very technical, very narrow reading of the arguments. But then we had Gorsuch and Thomas filing a minority opinion which argued that the Supreme Court should have gone even further in eroding this important right of the workers. In fact, this opinion of Thomas and Gorsuch, it literally ends with what amounts to a judiciary begging someone, anyone at all, to present the court with a case that they can use to fully strip the decision found in the Garmin case from legal precedent. And I am not exaggerating this either. The opinion ends with the out-and-out request that this challenge is made, and then goes even further by actually telling any potential challengers exactly why to challenge the law so that the justices can more easily agree to it. Quote, "The parties here have not asked us to reconsider Garmin, nor is it necessary to do so to resolve this case. Nonetheless, in an appropriate case, we should carefully re-examine whether the law supports Garmin's unusual preemption regime. In doing so, I would bear in mind that any proper preemption inquiry must focus on the NLRA's text and ask whether federal law and state law are in logical contradiction such that it is impossible to comply with both." End quote. Thomas and Gorsuch basically said, they plainly said, "Please challenge Garmin, and challenge it on precisely these grounds, and you will win." And this highlights exactly the sort of thing that the liberal justices who co-signed this decision were agreeing to. The continuing conservative attacks on the basic right for workers to organize, strike, and fight for their own class well-being. Now, I understand that this was a minority decision, and the liberal justices signed on to the majority, which is a little bit less frightening, I guess. Now, the best possible interpretation of these justices joining the conservatives in this decision is that they signed on to it to give the least awful decision the majority and push the Thomas and Gorsuch opinion to a minority, basically making sure that the precedent focuses on a more narrow, technical reading. I think that's maybe what they were thinking, or at least that's what they were, kind of pushing out there in the media. I don't know if I believe them, to be honest. Basically, this is a lesser of two evils vote for sure. And I honestly have a hard time accepting this as a, being an out and out good thing. I get the argument, but I mean, what the hell, man? This is the Supreme Court. And they're just like, let's just agree with the obviously wrong judgment here because there is an even shittier judgment down the docket. And, at the end of the day, are they smarter than me? Probably, maybe. Better at the long game? Maybe. But I'm not so sure, to be honest with you. Sometimes I think that you really do need to just be right. Just be correct and be loud about it. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I know for sure that this was, that time, but, I don't know. If not now, when? And it's a bit of a shame, too, because Justice Jackson actually wrote a good dissent, a solo, out on an island dissent. So let's talk a little bit about that right now, because it was well written and it does make the correct arguments, despite what I think of this whole shenanigan. I'm going to quote a little bit here from a Supreme Court dissent, so please pardon the language. Quote, "Drawing the line between activities that constitute a protected strike on the one hand and unprotected actions for which employers may validly discipline employees on the other is a legally and factually complex task. Moreover, that task implicates important economic policy considerations about the relative bargaining power of labor and management that affect not only the parties to a particular labor dispute, but also our broader national economy. To affect Congress's intent, this court has consistently recognized that courts are not primary tribunals to adjudicate these issues. Rather, it is to the board that Congress in, in sorry, uh, when she mentions the board here. It's the National Labor Relations Board. Rather, it is to the board that Congress entrusted the task of applying the Act's general language in the light of the infinite combinations of events which might be charged as violative of its terms. And the board, if it is to accomplish the task which Congress set for it, necessarily must have authority to fill the interstices of these broad statutory provisions. So while the board's decision is not the last word on these complex matters, given that its decisions are subject to review in federal court, it must assuredly be the first. For that reason, this court has long held that courts presented with claims arising out of a labor dispute must sometimes pause their proceedings to permit the board to consider the dispute in the first instance. As relevant here, we have held that if subsection 7, including its protection of the right to strike, arguably protects the conduct at issue in state court suits, then the court must await the board's word as to whether the conduct is in fact protected. End quote. I know that was long, but I think it was important. Basically, what she argues here, and accurately, I might add, is that the line between what is protected by these Garmin-based precedents and what is not is nearly always anything but clear-cut and easily discerned. In fact, the line is so blurry that the Supreme Court has repeatedly demanded that the courts actually do not decide these things and that all of these cases should run through the NLRB first, a bureau which actually specializes in labor issues. And in my opinion, anyway, and as flawed as the NLRB is, and many of its decisions are flawed, this is the right way to handle this, or at, you know, at the very least, it's the best way to handle it which currently exists. This isn't a brave thing to say or argue as a Supreme Court justice. It's literally just restating previous precedents and decisions for golf claps and MSNBC praise. If we allow the line between intentional destruction and damages that simply result from a strike, but were not intentional, if we let that line get this blurry and this thin, then we begin to tread on some very dangerous ground. Every time a union is sued in some edge case and it goes to the Supreme Court and they see this Glacier precedent, it gets just that much easier to say that the next thing is not arguably subject. And then it's the next edge case and so on, and eventually the edge becomes the center and unions are dead. Precedents like this don't always go away in an instant. This is just the beginning. This is how Roe versus Wade was slowly winnowed away. This is exactly what Thomas and Gorsuch were asking for in their decision. They're just looking for reasons to at least push the line even further, you know, in companies' favor and away from the workers of this country, if not just to destroy that line outright. This line is incredibly hard to hold, even under the best of circumstances, and these are not the best of circumstances, my friends. If companies can claim damages in this way, then every company will sue for the smallest of damages, if for no other reason than to just slowly bleed unions dry financially. And even if all of those cases were to be thrown out after months or years of legal battles, the damage to the union's coffers would be enormous. And if these lines remain this thin and this blurry and are being decided by overly myopic and technical courts, then the workers could be held liable for things as absurd as lost revenues or even spoiled goods. And yes, there are precedents, you know, protecting workers in these regards, like I mentioned earlier. But this decision is the first blow landed in what will surely become a sustained attack on these rights and protections. This decision will not be where the line stops, and this is why the liberal justices who signed on to this decision are so fundamentally wrong, I think. They're arguing that they're justified because of a narrow reading, but that narrow reading is the Slim Jim sliding into the door to unlock it. Eventually, the bad guys will get in, and they will make striking for better wages and benefits so costly and so fraught for the workers that they will simply stop doing it. It will no longer be an option. This would be an absolute disaster for hundreds of millions of working class folks in this country. Okay, so now, how did we get to where we are right now? It's especially curious since right now the United States has been experiencing an upsurge in union activity, a large increase in general approval of organized labor from the population, and a move by established unions into more militant stances. And those last few sentences are exactly why we are here right now, talking about this horrible decision. The country is siding with unions more and more, and those in power are digging in their heels. If they can't get their workers to reject working together for better lives, then they'll strip those lives away using the legal system and political lobbying. Now, one of the ways which, you know, all these corporate dorks out there pressured the courts for this decision was via amicus briefs, which are basically a way for people completely uninvolved in the case to get their own quote-unquote expertise or insight read into the proceedings and to the justices. Yes, this is a very strange system we have here. And while an amicus brief or friend of the court filing may have some level of rationalization, you know, as to legal cases, like an actual concerned third party might offer a suggestion as to reading precedent or some other nonsense, you know, some, technical expertise particular to a certain, industry maybe. These things are being used as something akin to lobbying in politics. They are just a shortcut for powerful organizations to get in the ears of justices and to influence how they rule on cases. These amicus briefs, the particular ones in this case, were filed by such enemies of the people as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the National Retail Federation, and the National Restaurant Association. And they are nothing short of lobby campaigners paid for by the wealthy. It is absolutely straight-up corruption. Also included in the amicus filers is a billionaire libertarian ghoul Charles Koch's State Policy Network, the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, and the Buckeye Institute. All of those are horrible people and horrible institutions. Oh, and by the way, Koch's various political groups helped fund the election of Trump, and then funded the careers and appointments of at least three Supreme Court justices, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, via the Federalist Society, all of whom Trump appointed. So these briefs, these amicus briefs, they all argued the same basic points, that unions are killing America. Seriously, it was not subtle. Some of the arguments presented were, to first source a Jacobin article here, quote, "In these briefs, lobbyists vilify unions as aggressive and depict corporations as helpless, warning of stark consequences, such as lawless activity, intentional property damage, violence, and misconduct if the high court were to side with their workers," end quote. These briefs were an effort to influence the Supreme Court to undercut labor's ability to fight for what they believe is fair and righteous by using the greatest weapon they possess, the strike. The ability to withhold their labor and leverage concessions from their employers. To quote one of the briefs, quote, "Throwing out the case creates a risk of stark consequences for employers, many of whom are already facing aggressive acts by unions and their members around the country," end quote. And one last bit from another brief, quote, "But so long as unions are allowed to engage in lawless activity and employers lack recourse," imagine that, employers lacking recourse, what a buffoon. Sorry. "But so long as unions are allowed to engage in lawless activity and employers lack recourse, any union willing to destroy or threaten to destroy an employer's property will have the upper hand in negotiations," end quote. All of this is to suggest that corporate America is under attack from violent saboteurs hell-bent on chaos and driven by evil. Every single one of these briefs is not written as genuine concern for legal issues or to offer specialized insight in the way that amicus briefs might rightly be used. Rather, it is a wholesale attack on the power of unions, funded by billionaires in an effort to corrupt the judicial process. Indeed, it is to destroy the very rights of organized labor, which is laid out plainly here. And, I guess I have one more quote here to read. Quote, allowing unions to treat intentional property damage as bargaining strategy would encourage its use, exacerbate violence and property damage in connection with labor disputes, and undermine the industrial peace that the National Labor Relations Act is intended to further. The incentive for those involved in labor disputes, often heated contests, to engage in misconduct is evident, and it will be enhanced and thus more frequent if doing so is risk-free. End quote. That was from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, by the way. And then to top off this amicus brief fiasco, and it was indeed a fiasco, one final friend of the court filing came in. It was sent by the Biden administration itself. Yes, the administration of the man who has spent years claiming to be the most labor-friendly president in American history. His administration filed a brief with the court saying that it should overrule the state court and make the same state court try this lawsuit without involving the NLRB, effectively stabbing the working man in the back and the face and the chest and the neck and the hip as well. If this weren't so expected, I'd go so far as to say that this is a betrayal of the entire working class. And that betrayal, as I aim to wrap this up, I think is the heart of the matter here. And, you know, I guess not betrayal because that word would require someone being on our side in the first place, which these people were not. So let's say a reaffirmation of the status quo is really the heart of the matter here. If we strip away the legal mumbo jumbo, a month ago, before this ruling, the laws of this country, despite the hyperbole of those amicus brief quotes I read, were already slanted heavily against labor. Things like limits on where one can picket or how many people can picket or bans on secondary strikes or where you could fart next to a strike area. The legal ability to replace workers with scabs and so on. All of this was slanted against labor and in favor of capital. This lopsided power dichotomy has been present, of course, since the country's founding. And now it adds in the threat that the workers could be sued for damaged property as a result of a strike rather than through direct action. And this is incredibly dangerous for unions just on the financial aspects alone. Every lawsuit over damages, legit or not, costs money and time to defend. Money which bleeds reserves, and time which saps resolve, but also hamstrings further action. It also throws into confusion what is and isn't acceptable in a strike, and puts it into tort law at the state level, which is wholly unqualified to decide these issues rather than the NLRB. In fact, it threatens the very point of a strike. Every single strike is meant to harm the employer. That's just a simple fact. It is literally the point of a strike. By withholding our labor, we harm the employer by not producing for them and preventing them from robbing us of our surplus value. This is how the process works. Further, we picket and prevent others from taking our places or buying already produced products. This is the very heart of a strike. This is where its power lies. This ruling kicks open the door to suing unions not just for blatant sabotage, but also potential and unrealized damages, not to mention lost income and even potentially from spoiled product. If the actions which are potentially covered by this Glacier case are robbed of labor, then the strike is taken from us as well. And then we are all but unarmed in this class war, at least legally. Workers can withhold their labor, even if the law doesn't protect them, but obviously that's fraught with other issues. The withholding of our labor, the strike, is, in fact, labor's single greatest weapon. It's a weapon we wield in the face of an otherwise insurmountably stacked deck. The capitalist owners are able to control workers through an implied and applied threat. without money. We starve, we go without shelter, and, you know, we could either live generally miserable lives, or maybe we just die. We get healthcare only as a condition of us working for them. The coercion is as brazen as it is incessant. And beyond even this most basic of ideas is that they control the political power and they, you know, that they actually constructed, built, support, fund, and control huge swaths of the legal system in this country. Right from the top with the Supreme Court, as we see with this ruling, and right on down to the street-level cops, which they use as the armed, violent fist of their rule. And all we have as workers is the ability to not work. And no matter how loudly these corporate dorks cry, how savagely these judicial ghouls pound their gavels, or how loudly these political hacks scream about how out of control the workers are, capital still has an overwhelming ability to enforce their will upon the working class. The workers have never had the power in this country, and they don't have it now. Will they ever truly hold it in the future? I don't know, but to make an argument that they have it now doesn't border on farcical. It resides at farcical's geographic center. There's a reason why corporate goobers like Biden rise and remain at the top of the political hierarchy, and that they have done so since the founding of this country. It's because they side with power. None of this should be shocking. There's a reason why the most outsider president of my lifetime is a billionaire landlord scumbag. It's because those people like him have the power, they side with power, and they will not give up the power. They have the power, they wield that power. They know where they stand, where we stand, and they know and understand and act upon something that the workers in this country are currently still trying to wrap their heads around. Class solidarity. And it works. And it works especially well around here because the rich, powerful bosses are the only class right now, the only class actors who behave like this is a real dynamic and that solidarity keeps them on top. There are more of us, the proletarians, than there are of them, the bourgeoisie, the capital. That is why the strike, solidarity, and collective bargaining and collective action are the ultimate weapon that we can wield to bring us victories. The ruling class knows this, and that's why they aim so clearly to divide us over nonsense, to convince us that things like raises are a thing to fight for individually, that promotions are to be fought and clawed and contested over, that working together to help the next person up is detrimental to our own welfare. When the workers are angry, the bosses want us to talk to them alone, one-on-one, and to work things out individually. Because we have no strength alone, they hold all the cards. They'll do anything at all to keep us from working together because they know that that is how we can win. If those in power can manipulate the Supreme Court to take away the single most important weapon that workers have, the ability to legally withhold our power, then those in power can disregard, easily and safely, every single demand that we have. The powerful have no fear of some, you know, like lone dork carrying dog-eared copies of The Fountainhead and How to Win Friends and Influence People, you know, with their stiff collar, polo shirt, and sensible shoes. They fear a million sinewy field workers, sore-footed nurses, broke teachers, and grounded pilots all unified in their demands. This is why the Supreme Court overturned the lower court in this case. It was not to uphold the law or to help workers. It was to continue the decades-old process of slowly eroding our rights as citizens and workers, the very body that was supposedly created to defend the rights of the people from tyranny, has become dedicated to not only disempowering workers, but also in buttressing the power of the already entrenched ruling class. They serve this tyranny. The Supreme Court is weakening, with this decision, the very fabric of the social structure by furthering the imbalance of power and shredding the tacit social contract that holds this whole thing together. They're doing it by shearing away the ability of the working class to strike, to effectively resist. If they continue down this road, then the workers of this country will have two choices: submit entirely or not. And I will leave you with this statement in response to the decision by the Teamsters General President, Sean O'Brien. The political hacks at the Supreme Court have again voted in favor of corporations over working people. These corruptible justices should be ashamed of themselves for throwing out long-standing precedent and legislating from the bench. The ability to strike has been on the books for nearly 100 years, and it's no coincidence that this ruling is coming at a time when workers across the country are fed up and exercising their rights more and more. Make no mistake, this ruling has everything to do with giving companies more power to hobble workers if any attempt is made to fight back against a growing system of corruption. The Supreme Court is not upholding the law, nor is it advancing the American people. Supreme Court justices are ruling on behalf of billionaires alone, the very ones they socialize with at cocktail parties and who they owe their jobs to in the first place. American workers must remember that their right to strike has not been taken away. All workers, union and non-union alike, will forever have the right to withhold their labor. The Teamsters will strike any employer when necessary, no matter their size or the depth of their pockets. Unions will never be broken by this court or any other. Today's shameful ruling is simply one more reminder that the American people cannot rely on their government or their courts to protect them. They cannot rely on their employers. We must rely on each other. We must engage in organized, collective action. We can only rely on the protections inherent in the power of our unions. And that, my friends, is the end of the episode. I thank you guys for being here. I guess that's it. You know, if you're on YouTube, like, subscribe, leave a comment. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe. There's a Buy Me a Coffee page if you can spare a couple bucks a month or make a one-time donation. And that's it. Thank you guys for listening. I love you all.